Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Environmental History. My name is David Fauser. I'm today joined by Jim Clifford, Associate Professor of Environmental History at the University of Saskatchewan and the author of West Ham and the River Lee, A Social and Environmental History of London's Industrialized Marshland, 1839 to 1914, University of British Columbia Press. Jim, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So could you begin by telling us some of your personal background, how you became an environmental historian, and the trajectory that led you up to the beginning of this research project?
Sure. So I completed an MA at Wilfrid Laurier University, focused on more of a cultural history of poverty in East London, sort of representations of poverty in the 1890s, around the period of New Unionism. And I applied to do a PhD at York University on a sort of slightly expanded version of that project. In the 6 months between proposing that and arriving to start my PhD, I became kind of more interested in environmental politics and more aware that environmental history was kind of this growing subfield. So decided to do one of my fields in the history of science, environment, medicine, this kind of combined field at York. In the course of doing that field, getting to know Colin Coates, who was one of the field supervisors, I became more and more intrigued with environmental history and began rethinking how I could do a history of East London through more of an environmental history lens, as opposed to the cultural social history that I'd done before. Still bringing in my interest in social and cultural history, but focus more on an environmental topic. So I started looking for something compelling. I thought about maybe a history of one of the big parks in East London. But then I stumbled across John Marriott's work and realized there was a second significant river that flowed through a major industrial zone through the lower Lee Valley and into the Thames, right on the eastern edge of London during the time period I was interested in. Marriott had done his work in the 1980s, and there was some attention to environmental issues there, but it really wasn't the focus. So I thought this was a good opportunity to explore the history of a river. There'd been lots of great work in American environmental history that had sort of rivers at their focus, and a few a few European environmental histories of rivers, but not a lot in Britain aside from a book on the Thames embankment that had been done at that point.
And so the River Lee then and the Lee Valley really gets you to West Ham. It gets you this East London connection that you've had for some time. And it gets you into poverty and unionism as well, but with an environmental dimension. And then onto that, you added HGIS. Can you talk to us a little bit about HGIS as a method and how you came to that and how you were able to apply that here in this study?
Sure. So I first arrived at the Newham Local Studies Library and Archive in Stratford and what was West Ham. And one of the first things that the staff showed me were these large 5 foot to the mile ordnance survey maps of the area, and they're kind of overwhelming when you first experience them as printouts.
Hang on.
It's very difficult.
Can I just clarify? You said 5 feet to the mile.
Yes.
Wow, that's
enormous. It's a very, very high resolution. They're just enormous, which means each individual map is something like a meter by a meter and only encompasses a small part of this one suburb in East London. And then they have two of these ordnance surveys, one where the surveying was done in mostly the early 1870s, and then it was resurveyed in 1893 to 1895. So you're sitting there on a big table trying to compare two giant maps to kind of get a sense of how the landscape changed. And I left the archive, you know, kind of feeling overwhelmed, but also spending a lot of money on these reproductions of the maps that were available. And I got home, and then a few weeks after that trip, I had a chance to just sit down for lunch with Bill Turkell, who asked me about my project, and I explained a little bit about it. And he said, well, I guess you're going to use GIS then. And at that point, I was still pretty committed to not learning how to use PowerPoint, avoiding almost any kind of digital technology beyond a word processor. So I kind of at first didn't know how to respond, didn't really know what GIS was, but he convinced me that it was something I needed to look into. About a year later, I finally had some confidence because of some great help from actually the UFT map librarian, Marcel Fortin, taught me the kind of basic skills I needed to be able to do the work properly. And after, I think, one database that I had to completely delete and start over because I'd done it all wrong, I started kind of recording all the key features in these scanned maps that I stitched together and geo-referenced, and then found all the factories, all the major streets, and an array of other kind of landscape features in these two different time points, and was able to start to really systematically look at how the built environment and the landscape transformed between kind of the beginning of the really rapid urban industrial development in the region and its peak in the 1890s.
What would you say is the timeline of this rapid industrialization? What are the key moments?
So it really gets started with the arrival of the railroad in 1839. So that's sort of where I really start the book, although I do look at some earlier developments of calico printing and a few small factories that are built along the main road through northern West Ham earlier in the 19th century.
So yeah,
but it's really
sorry. Could we spend just another couple of minutes on that to get to 1839? What is the place like before this industrial sort of blooming in the middle of the 19th century?
So we're really lucky that the first ordnance survey, not 5 feet to the mile, but still a very decent map, is done in 1805 for Essex. So we have this map where we can see that most of what in the parish of West Ham, what becomes the borough of West Ham, well, at least about half of it is marshland. And you can really see that there's almost no buildings on the marshland. This is considered unhealthy landscape. It probably was still malarial into the beginning of the 19th century. So they built their houses on the edge of the marsh. They reclaimed quite a bit of the marsh for market gardening, vegetable gardening, and also to fatten cattle on their way in to the city. So it was used pretty intensely for agriculture, but it was still kind of this wetland that had agricultural ditches to sort of make it more useful, some walls along the river to keep the flooding at bay. But the map still labeled as marshland at the beginning of the 19th century.
And so some of those interventions into the sort of water landscape there were quite old. Is that right? That some of them go back to the 17th century or even before?
Yeah, my understanding of the medieval history, this is based on the work of others, is that this area had been pretty heavily reclaimed up until the Black Death. Large parts of the Thames estuary reclamation then are sort of allowed to go back to marshlands, because it's very labor intensive to maintain these defenses. And then during the mid 16th century, they slowly start doing that work again. And over the centuries, sort of two centuries that follow, they reclaim a few thousand acres of marshland for agricultural use. And that kind of gets us up to the start of the 19th century in this new transformation towards urban industrial use.
Were the borders of West Ham fairly stable?
Yeah, fairly stable as a parish. As with everything in London, there's kind of overlapping definitions. So the West Ham Poor Law Union is much larger than the West Ham Parish and later the borough. But yeah, more or less, it's with small alterations stable between the early 19th century and it's when it's abolished in 1965.
So we have this, I guess we could say, an agricultural suburb of the metropolis, which has gone through some changes. There's been some ebb and flow, but then things really get moving quite dramatically in new directions in the late 1830s with the arrival of the railroad. Can you pick it up from there?
Yeah. So the railroad comes first. You know, basically they're limited in the early 19th century in how much you can expand industry, because most industries are relying on either tidal water power or windmills. But with the arrival of the railroad and with steam engines more generally, we see a real intensification of industrialization. So first, sort of, a lot of it happens in the Lower Lee Valley along these kind of braided back rivers, most of which are probably at least partially artificial, dug for water mills at some point in time. It's a good place for industrialization at this point, because you have access to the railroad to bring the product to market into the city and access to the waterway to carry the coal that you need for powering the steam engines or heating the industrial process at the factories. And at this point, coal is just too expensive to move by rail. So you'll notice, looking at my maps of industry across Greater London, almost all the factories, especially factories built during the 19th century, are built very close to a waterway.
And so they would consume all this coal that was brought almost always by water, and then the finished articles, and I suppose some of the other raw materials as well, came in on rail?
Yeah, I think the rail is probably mostly used for finished articles. The rail does railway does a few other things. Soon after the main line comes out, they build an extension down to North Woolwich, and that opens up the south of West Ham. You get the very first factories in Silvertown on the Thames, right down at the bottom of West Ham. A rubber factory is located there in the mid-1850s. And then this also eventually is the location where they build a major dock, the Victoria Dock, the largest dock, I think, in London at the time. And so this is the second big piece of transportation infrastructure that helps spur off the incredibly rapid urban industrial development in the second half of the 19th century. So that dock comes in 1855.
When the dock, or when the railroad first and then the dock are financed and constructed, are they done with a specific intention to develop this region? I mean, do they look at this and say, wow, here's this region of marshland, but if we had a railroad there, we could really do something with it?
I think the railroad is, you know, it's the railroad, the Great Eastern Railroad, heading out of the city. So I don't think that's the kind of core goal. The dock is attracted, or the dock builders are attracted to the area because it's going to be cheaper to construct the dock, because the land is so low. It's lower than high tide in the Thames estuary. it means you have to excavate a lot less dirt, which presumably is still a very expensive process using steam and animal and human power. So that was kind of one of the main reasons to locate the dock in this otherwise very remote location in the mid-19th century.
That's fascinating. I hadn't thought of the railroad as going elsewhere. Does it go through, is this like the London to Colchester route or something like that?
Yeah, it splits. So one of the lines does go to Colchester, I believe, and another one heads sort of northeast. It splits in Stratford. And then there's a second line that is now a part of the tube system that kind of goes out to the edge of Greater London, of modern Greater London.
All right. And so they begin to build factories in West Ham that are relying on coal brought by water, as well as the rail links. What kinds of facilities are these? And if you could point out some of the neighborhoods that they're in today.
Yeah, so there's two main centers of industry in West Ham. The first is the Lower Lee Valley, basically in the western edge of Stratford. And most simply, it's basically where the Olympics were developed in the past decade. So the Queen Elizabeth Park today was sort of the northern edge of industry, and the whole area has gone through kind of massive redevelopment since I started this project, with new condo buildings being constructed every time I get to the area. So these are mostly fairly small factories, at least by the standard of the later 19th century. They did a whole array of things. Some of the early ones were kind of small chemical factories making or burning lime, small kind of fine chemical company that eventually becomes the main producer of quinine in Britain. Lots of dye and other fertilizer and other chemical factories. So it really kind of drew some of the more noxious factories. And it's been argued since the 1850s that they arrived in the area because there was less regulation than on the London side of the border, which I think is partially true, but it was probably overstated at the time, because when we look at all the factories on the London side of the border, there's really no shortage of noxious factories in southeast London or along the Isle of Dogs. So whatever public health regulations there were in London itself, they weren't being strictly enforced. But I still think factory owners probably saw the risk as being slightly lower in this industrial suburb where they could dominate the politics. Whereas there's always a future risk that the London government would become more aggressive. So I think it's a partial explanation, but it has to be alongside just how crucial the waterway was and how the Lee provided all these kind of free transportation network. There was no toll to move goods along the Lee, whereas the canals, like the Regent Canal or the Surrey Canal, you would have had to pay a toll to move your goods along that, which would increase the cost of industrial production along a canal.
So West Ham then really sits at the nexus of kind of multiple, both human and environmental dimensions. You have the proximity of the metropolis and the railroads coming into and out of it, along with the particular position of the river. And so I guess we could say the river here, the River Lee, is doing a lot of work for these factories in that it provides transportation. Is the water in the river as water? Is it a vital resource for these factories as well? Are these factories using a lot of water for their, either for production or for waste disposal?
So unfortunately, this is something that's really hard to nail down. So the simple answer is yes, because much of the water that came through the water system, the water supply, was taken out of the Lee to the north of West Ham, brought through filter beds and pipes and down into West Ham. So if they're using water from the East London Waterworks Company, then a lot of it would have been diverted Lee water. I have to imagine for some industrial processes, they could use the dirty water, but as the decades wore on, you really didn't want to use the Lee water because it was so full of pollution. There's this one example that we can see that calico printing had been very strong in the region. In fact, it's one of the first industries that arrives in the region in the 18th century, partly drawn there because of the purity of the River Lee water. And all of the calico printers are gone by about the 1870s. I think the water's become too dirty for them to continue to operate in the region. So my guess, based on that kind of limited evidence, is that mostly they would have used piped water, but probably for some industrial processes, they're kind of dirty, probably also somewhat brackish because it is still tidal. Water could have been used.
And you point out, though, that a big draw on the River Lee is the East London Waterworks, which draws upstream the relatively cleaner water. But that's essentially municipal water for households and, you know, other sort of small establishments, right?
But industry would have relied on that water supply as well.
Right. Okay. And so when does the East London Waterworks come into being?
I believe it's late 18th or early 19th century. The new river company dates much further back, I think, to the 17th century. They're also diverting Lee water from further north down into central London. It's the first private water company that brings this fresher water supply into the center of London. East London Waterworks Company is established later on as the population of East London starts to grow rapidly and there's a new demand for water supply in the East.
For both residential and business. And yes. Definitely population growth comes with industrialization. Can you describe the population growth of the region?
Yeah, it's fairly remarkable. It starts off around 6,000 people in the first census in 1801 and grows to over 250,000 by 1901, a century later. And much of the really rapid growth comes in the 1870s, 80s, and 1890s, and then it starts to level off in the first few decades of the 20th century, peaking in finally in 1921, before it starts at first slow and then a fairly rapid decline in the middle of the 20th century.
What's the population of it now? Do you know offhand?
Recently, I think the population of Newham has reached somewhere around what the population of West Ham was. So Newham is the combination of West Ham, East Ham, and North Woolwich. Mm. I think it's over 300,000, but yeah, I can't remember for sure. It's been growing quite fast since the beginning of the 21st century.
Interesting. So we have a real ebb and flow of people in this region, but without a doubt, the late 19th century is a period of absolutely tremendous growth, of exponential growth. How does the region handle this growth? And what kind of effect does this have on the Lee River and on the waterscape there?
So this is a challenge from the beginning. I look at these two really interesting documents produced in the mid-1850s, just as the docks are being built and the influx of a new population, especially down onto the former marshlands. This kind of reclaimed agricultural land begins in the 1850s with the arrival of the docks. First, Alfred Dickens, the brother of the famous author, who's a civil engineer, is sent in to write a report to see whether the parish needs its own board of health. And he documents pretty kind of appalling conditions and really makes a connection that I think remains throughout the rest of the century and into the 20th century. He makes the connection between kind of difficult environmental conditions and social problems in the region. So not surprisingly, people who end up living in these really dirty and to a certain extent dangerous environmental conditions are people with very little social capital, very few options. They arrive because there's work at the docks, there's work building the docks, and then later work unloading ships at the docks. And they end up in kind of the worst social conditions and the worst environmental conditions in the region.
And can you describe the social conditions? Are we talking about very poor quality housing? We're talking about high rates of disease, low wages. Are there, I mean, those are the sort of typical dimensions we might expect in a Victorian city. Is West Ham typical in that way, or does it have its own particular characteristics?
Yeah, in many ways, West Ham is an extension of the East End of London, with slight differences in that most of the housing is a bit newer, but a lot of it was built sort of by speculative jerry builders. So especially the early housing built in the 1850s and 60s is a very low quality. They're building on this marshland, and it's described in a few of the sources that maybe they bring in a certain amount of kind of basically garbage to bring up the level a certain amount and then build a house on top of that. So by the turn of the 20th century, they have major problems with their foundations. But basically, it's really cheaply built housing. And then on top of that, you often end up with two or more families living in these two up, two down houses that were constructed for one single family. So you end up with this sort of intense overcrowding in poorly built housing. And if you look at a map of particularly Canning Town, which is down just north of the docks, built on the former marshlands, and you look at the way the streets were laid out, it was the marsh drainage ditches that kind of shaped the pattern of Canning Town. So that leads to major problems early on because these ditches are not designed to be sewers. They're designed to keep the water table down enough so you can fatten cattle or grow potatoes. When you start dumping human waste into these ditches, most of it just sits there for months at a time, as Alfred Dickens found. And then, you know, every year or two, there's a major flood that would clear out the sewage and just spread it right across the landscape and into the homes. So the constant exposure to human waste was kind of a pretty dramatic public health challenge in these early decades. It gets better as the decades go on. You know, eventually they do build a pipe sewer network that gets the sewage out of people's backyards. But a lot of it for, you know, through to the end of the 19th century is then just dumped into the lower River Lee, where the tide moves it up and down throughout the daily cycle. And you know, it takes a while to finally get flushed out to sea. So human waste remains one of the big challenges for local environmental conditions and public health in the region.
And can we connect that to specific epidemiological problems or indicators of health?
Yeah, so there's a chapter in the book that really focuses in on this challenge that the region faces. And the best indicator is infant mortality, which is at least the fluctuation is largely driven by diarrhea, which becomes a bigger problem in hot weather over the summer and declines over the winter. We can also see in a few of the other sort of diseases that are spread through human waste, like typhoid fever and cholera, which there's an outbreak in 1866. The last cholera outbreak in London is kind of its epicenter is in the Lower Lee Valley.
Now, you mentioned earlier that one of the things that attracted some developers to West Ham is that they could escape regulation or the threat of regulation within the city itself, right? I wonder, you know, because if we think of cholera epidemics in, you know, early or mid-Victorian Britain, we think of some of the earlier epidemics in central London, and then there's some remedies to these. So the London mainline sewers completed in what, about 1860 or so? And so
shortly after that. Yeah.
So does West Ham sort of lag behind in these measures to help combat disease? And I guess we could say lag behind in the sanitary movement more broadly.
Yes, that's a slightly complicated question. I'd probably mostly urge people to go to Christopher Hamlin's excellent work on this topic and Bill Lucan. I've tried to look at it myself in the context of West Ham and the River Lee. But the simple answer is that today we look back at the Broad Street pump and, you know, see it as this kind of remarkable moment in the history of medicine when Snow identifies water as the vector for the spread of the disease. But he doesn't sort of immediately convince all medical professionals or the courts that his new theory is in fact correct. So in 1866, when cholera arrives again, there's strong suspicion that it's the East London Waterworks reservoirs that are built far too close to the River Lee, and that there's seeping of water from the River Lee, which has sewage in it, into these kind of open reservoirs that are immediately adjacent to the river. But there's still enough scientific doubt that officials are reluctant to blame the East London Water Works Company alone, because they see all kinds of other evidence of this sort of strong correlation between poverty and filth and bad smells and the centers of, you know, the worst cholera death rates in East London. So they're still not entirely sure. You know, there's a strong suspicion. There's definitely some scientific experts that, you know, are convinced the East London Water Works Company was solely responsible. But there's still quite a bit of doubt. So again, Hamlin is the historian who's really looked into that in great detail. But West Ham was a part of the wider East London water network. It happened that this company had these poorly constructed reservoirs in the northern edge of West Ham, but it's not because West Ham was behind the times or had less of a regulatory regime. In fact, the East London Water Companies did break regulations. They weren't meant to have any big open air reservoirs feeding into London, so they were fined for that particular infraction because regulations existed that just hadn't been properly enforced.
Interesting. So you said in the regulatory regime, although the perceived lack of one may have contributed to some extent in the early development, we really don't see a whole lot of difference in, say, how West Ham is governed versus how other municipalities would be.
Yeah, I think that's largely true. You know, this is definitely a point of contention, depending on which historian.
Right.
You read, and you know, Chris Otter and others have made kind of different points, but there's just too many dirty industries left within the boundaries of the Metropolitan Board of Works and later the County of London to have me fully convinced that there's kind of this big jurisdictional draw to West Ham. And of course, by the end of the century, West Ham flips and becomes this hotbed of social democracy and tighter enforcement and regulation, which probably does eventually drive some of the businesses out of the area. But yeah, you know, to what extent factories arrived in the 1880s, I think there's got to be some truth to it. And it's probably not just about municipal government is also just remoteness. So the second major zone of industry is this area called Silvertown. In fact, it's one of the only parts of London that still has a few large-scale industry, the Tate & Lyle sugar factory is still in operation. So this is the whole area in the south of West Ham that fronts on the Thames. It's very remote, so it allowed much larger factories to be constructed, and they could offload raw materials directly from ocean-going vessels, which gave this region kind of a pretty strong competitive advantage for large-scale industrial manufacturing. And so I think if Silvertown had been a part of the County of London or the Metropolitan Board of Works, I think it would have developed in a fairly similar way because of its remoteness, because they knew there wasn't going to be a lot of complaints about smoke pollution or other, you know, environmental concerns when almost nobody lived anywhere near the region. So, yeah, I think it's a factor, but it can be overstated, especially in some of the primary sources from the 1850s through to the early 20th century that kind of presented as the sole factor, the main factor for industrialization in West Ham.
Right. Now, West Ham does have somewhat different living conditions to, say, the East End of London, which you outline in the book. Can you describe a little bit more about the social history of, you know, the basic experience of living in West Ham versus other parts of the metropolis?
Yeah, so I think the main difference is just that it's on the edge of the metropolis at this time period. So Peter Thorsheim has done this excellent work on kind of the desperate effort to build parks in the old East End, where they cleared graveyards because there was so little open space, and, you know, actual concerns with kids getting rickets because they had so little exposure to sunlight in this very dense urban landscape in a, you know, an area like Whitechapel. When you get out to West Ham, there's still quite a bit of open land intermixed between the factories and the new streets of housing that are springing up constantly over the last decades of the 19th century. Some of this is through actual efforts. There's West Ham Park, which was bought by the Corporation of the City of London and kind of donated as a charitable act. So quite a sizable park in the heart of West Ham. And a few other recreation grounds that are preserved by the borough council to provide space for recreation for the people of West Ham. But you also just get areas of kind of open marsh that are never developed for either industry or housing. That, you know, the limited oral histories we have from people who lived here at the time kind of described you know, catching birds and allotment gardening and, you know, just other kind of activities in this hybrid natural space that was not easily available to a kid growing up in Whitechapel in the same decade. So being this kind of area on the edge with constant change, constant development, a lot of instability had a lot of negative consequences for the people living in the area. But there were some clear benefits: access to allotment gardens, access to just open green space, the ability to basically walk out of the city within 5 to 10 kilometers. You could go north, east, or take an under-river tunnel into the hills in Kent. You know, you could go for a walk with your dad to a pub way out, you know, in the countryside, pretty readily from Canning Town, and that is described in some of the oral histories. Just that access to the rural landscape, which is in fairly close proximity still at the turn of the 20th century.
So if we wanted an example of a kind of urban-rural interface, I mean, West Ham is it. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, this is precisely what my book's about, is these decades where it's transforming from a still predominantly rural landscape to heavily industrialized and populated with 250,000 people. But even in the 1895 maps, I think I find 5 or 6 farms that are still in West Ham itself. And there's significantly more farmland just over the border of West Ham into East Ham or north into the Lee Valley. So it's this kind of patchwork landscape that continues to have heavy industry and densely populated suburbs in close proximity to a working farm, a large area of marshland that hasn't been developed and is used as allotment gardens, or just sort of open marshland that you could wander through and connect to the countryside in the north or the east.
Now, you also describe in the book how the rapid industrialization and the intense industrialization of this region has profound effects on the water, on the waterscape that is there, and ultimately has pretty negative effects for industry. Can you talk about that? Can you talk about some of the drawbacks that emerge for industry in West Ham over time?
Yes, so this is a real benefit of doing the work with HGIS that we started talking about a little while ago. It's fairly painstaking work. In the dissertation stage of this project, I worked with these 5 feet to the mile maps and just identified every factory, every street, all the rivers within West Ham. And the process of doing that kind of data entry of creating these little polygons across every factory, you start to notice not just the change that happened, but the change that didn't happen. So that kind of started to raise questions in my mind. Why are there all these factories along Carpenter Road, but on the other side of this particular back river, it never gets developed? Why does Mill Mead never get developed? And so, that led me back to the archival sources, and I found increasing discussion in the late 1890s, in the first years of the 20th century, in just the terrible condition of the back rivers in particular. So these are rivers that were never turned into actual canals. And in the mid-19th century, were quite passable by barge. But as they kind of filled in with garbage, with material brought by the river from the north, over time, they became so clogged and nobody was responsible for dredging them that you could only pass up many of these rivers during the spring tide, so the highest tide in the monthly cycle. So there'd be a day or two, maybe 3 days, that these rivers were passable during the high tide, and then that whole area wouldn't be accessible by boat for another lunar cycle. So there's constant discussion about the need to address this problem starting in the 1890s, but for a whole variety of reasons, nothing is ever done. And we kind of see the end of industrial expansion in this region as the rivers became, the rivers that once drew industry to the region became so polluted and damaged that they're actually kind of actively working against the economic success of the region. That combines with a few other major changes, electrification, the use of trucks on roads that we see in Greater London, that the factories that are built in the early 20th century, especially in the interwar period, mostly happen up the Lee Valley or in Brent and in northwest London. A few other main regions where sort of roads and railways are more important in shaping the location of industry by the 1920s. than rivers are, because you know, why would you want to build on a factory on marshland that floods every few years if you don't need the river to deliver coal? If you can use electricity as your main source of energy, then there's no good reason to build on marshlands anymore, unless you have some kind of other major raw material that you need to bring in by boat.
Yeah, I thought that dimension was such a fascinating part of this whole study, was the very relatively short temporal window in which it made sense to industrialize and develop this region, and how then that window really, really closed. And this I think gets us to the second half of the book, which is really about the way that environmental conditions shape the politics of the region. And West Ham becomes well known for its politics in support of labor and social democracy. And you really jump into this issue with the municipal election in the late 1890s. Can you start us there and then walk us through?
Sure. So West Ham is, in fact, it's known for two firsts in British labor political history. It's the first place to elect an independent labor MP. There'd been a few Labour MPs that were sort of in coalition with the Liberal Party, but Keir Hardie is the first independent with no affiliation with the Liberal Party to get elected in 1893. He's a Scottish Labour activist, but runs in this seat where he thinks he has the best chance of winning. He only lasts in Parliament for 2 years and loses the next election. So the next big sort of step forward for labor is the victory of the labor group in 1898. This is a couple of years before what becomes the National Labor Party is established. So really at the forefront of this kind of new labor politics that's developing in a few centers around Britain at the time. And so most of the previous historiography focused on the importance of new unionism, so efforts to unionize unskilled laborers at docks, at the big coal gas works that are located in and around West Ham, and the Brian May match girls strike a few years in 1889, I think, or 1888. It's kind of these crucial developments in labor history and people forming into unions as being the main factor that explains the early success of labor politicians in the region. And I don't take away from that being a major factor, but I don't think it's the sole factor. I think people's experience of living in this very unstable, flood-prone, dirty environment created another kind of alienation and grievance from the wider establishments in London, a sense that people in East London, people in West Ham, were at a significant disadvantage from people in West London or South London who didn't deal with the same constant environmental challenges that they did in the East End and in West Ham. So this gets us to a particular event that's mentioned in passing in the earlier histories of this 1898 election, a prolonged water famine where they turned off the water for about 20 hours a day. So they turned on for 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the evening. So this begins at the end of August in 1898, and it's still in effect when the election happens in early November. There's kind of two separate votes in the municipal political system at the time. They happen about a week apart in early November. And so for a variety of reasons, one, the franchise is still fairly restricted. So a lot of the people who are involved in new unionism don't necessarily have the vote. And, you know, based on the fact that conservatives continue to win the national elections on either side of this 1898 breakthrough, also that the labor group is thrown out of power 2 years later. So there's still a lot of factors working against the success of a labor coalition that's a mix of socialists and also some liberals who are just committed to the labor cause. So I'm convinced, I argue in the book, that it takes this environmental event, a prolonged drought and an inefficient monopoly water supply system that creates this grievance that can get more centrist liberals behind this new upstart political movement. And we see this very clearly in the liberal newspaper, who abandon their support for the liberal politicians and endorse the labor group kind of despite their socialism, but because they'd shown such strong leadership on the water question. So I think it's really kind of crucial to look in tandem the way that consumer politics around this crucial utility, the water supply, combined with labor politics and kind of allowed this early victory to happen in West Ham a few years before anywhere else in the country.
In a sense, it almost reinforces a kind of it sort of almost deepens the materialism of a kind of Marxian analysis of class consciousness and you know, political response by suggesting that it's not merely the sort of working conditions, but also the broader environmental conditions as a basic material reality, that is people's water.
Yeah, like to a large extent, this work that I'm doing is kind of in response to much of what I read, as a comprehensive student at the beginning of my PhD, where British cultural and social historians, some really turned away from materialism and became fixated on language as this kind of core element that mediated the way politics developed, and really argued that we see much more of a continuity in liberalism. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for those arguments developed by some great scholars. But I think, you know, we need to bring materialism back into it. And, you know, while the language limited the way people engaged with these issues, they had this very visceral experience of not having enough water, of having the water shut off for 20 hours a day, of smelling the sewage that are in all these local rivers that flow through the center of town, of seeing very high infant mortality rates, you know, experiencing the loss of children, siblings, or neighbors on a just very regular basis. I think all these factors kind of combine to help galvanize a sense of grievance, a new demand for a different kind of politics, a greater level of government intervention to start solving some of these urban environmental and public health problems that have been endemic in the region for decades and that the political elite had really failed to address.
Can you develop the infant mortality dimension of this? When precisely does infant mortality peak in West Ham, and when does it really begin to come down in significant ways?
So in some ways, West Ham follows the kind of broader London and national trend. Infant mortality is on the rise during the 1890s. They brought in a medical officer of health, a new medical officer of health in the late 1880s. And he's just struggling for the first decade and a half that he's in the job to deal with crisis after crisis. And in part, it's the weather. In the 1890s, they have a series of quite hot summers, which really exacerbate the urban environmental problems with, you know, high levels of human waste and horse manure in the city, and the kind of cloud of flies that would develop over a hot summer to spread the germs from the privies and the leaking pipes back into the households and, you know, into the infant food supply, the tins of milk or what have you. So the 1890s are bad years, but we have this kind of tool called the sanitary test that Graham Mooney developed, I think in the late 1990s, of just looking at how one municipality does compared to other municipalities. And you can see that West Ham is kind of underperforming in the 1890s. In the early 1880s, it's kind of in the middle of the pack. If we look across Greater London, the infant mortality rates are fairly high, but they're similar to a place like Fulham or other similarly located districts on the western edge of London at the time. And then at the end of the 1890s, they're amongst the worst. They're one of the worst regions in Greater London. They're in fact reaching a level where they're one of the worst across England and Wales. They get to the point at the peak, which I think is in 1899, I think is the worst year, where it's more than one in five infants are dying before the age of one. So really quite startling numbers that were common in quite a few cities in Europe in the 19th century. But a few decades earlier, it was maybe 180 or so per thousand and had climbed up to the low 200s per thousand in the worst years at the end of the 1890s. And then we see a pretty remarkable turnaround, partly because the weather gets better for infant mortality, at least. They have cooler summers for the first decade of the 19th century, right through to about 1911. But second of all, we see a pretty significant interventionist policy from the municipal government. They give the medical officer of health, Charles Sanders, new resources, new employees, and they decide to actually start going house by house instead of waiting for complaints from the residents. They'd actually target the worst districts and look for any problems, particularly with drainage, and then demand that the landlords fix the problems. If the landlord didn't fix the problem, they'd send their own workers in to fix the problem and bill the landlord and take them to court. So they kind of became much, much more aggressive, which is a big shift in local politics because a few years earlier, it was the landlords themselves that sort of dominated city council, and there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm for this kind of aggressive approach. But with the rise of labor and even a few of the more centrist liberals willing to back this, in the first decade of the 20th century, they fixed thousands of broken drains across the region. They try and make sure that every household has a garbage pail with a lid. That helps control the fly population to a certain extent. They increase the effort to wash the streets, which is an effort to get rid of the horse manure. And of course, this also coincides with the pretty steep decline in the horse population. Somewhere around the middle of the first decade of the 20th century, you really see the internal combustion engine start replacing many of the horses in the city. So that helps the situation. But we get to this next hot summer in 1911 and see that West Ham does much better. It's back in sort of the middle of the pack amongst the other local districts across Greater London. It's not keeping up with Hampstead that drops under one death per 10 live births, but it gets down much closer to the range of sort of 1.5, which is pretty impressive improvements in the course of a decade. And those improvements just continue into the teens and 20s until West Ham kind of follows most of the nation towards much lower infant mortality.
And so can we say then that this shift toward a more aggressively interventionist labor or social democratic politics really quite remarkably improved the living conditions of people in West Ham. I mean, over the space of a decade, it sounds like the infant mortality rate dropped by about a quarter. Is that about right?
Yeah. And it's very kind of, it improves the most in the worst parts of West Ham. So they kind of paid attention to the different wards, the different regions, and you see the steepest declines in the most impoverished districts that sort of had the shockingly high infant mortality rates. At the end of the 19th century, and see really impressive improvements in the decade that followed. You know, it's, I think, crucial to point out that the labor group itself is only in power for 2 years. So it's this broader shift. Because they can win an election, you see the response from the Tory and Liberal politicians is actually to form the Municipal Alliance. They come together to have a single block against the labor group, and you know, are fairly successful for the next decade in holding on to power. But they always have to, you know, their politics are dread much further towards this kind of social democratic intervention, probably quite often reluctantly, but knowing that if they if they're not seen to be kind of aggressively improving these urban environmental conditions, the risk of losing the election and letting the Labour Party come back into power is over, kind of hanging over all the decisions they make in that first decade of the 20th century.
How do they handle the question of the water supply?
This is dealt with actually nationally. So this whole election is fought over the labor group's willingness to be really aggressive on bringing about a municipal supply of water. But in the end, the national government takes control of the 8 water companies. They don't want the city of the County of London, the London County Council, to have control. There's a long history of the national government struggling to limit the power of this this very large metropolis and the capital. So kind of the compromise solution is to create kind of a separate government-owned water utility to supply water to the whole region. So that's, I think, finally enacted in the first year or two of the 20th century.
You close the book by discussing fixing the river and to some extent then fixing society. Can you tell us about what you mean by that?
So yeah, the last chapter of my book is a kind of very detailed look at something that doesn't happen. It's this effort during a prolonged unemployment crisis that starts in about 1904 to use this kind of new opportunity with money for public works for the unemployed to finally address the flooding and terrible condition of those back rivers in the Lower Lee Valley. So it begins with kind of two crises overlapping. There's a major flood in 1897, a second major flood in 1904. It does, you know, considerable damage to factories and housing in the low-lying areas of West Ham. West Ham can be hit from flooding in kind of three different ways. A heavy storm can just create localized flooding, and I think did just about every year. A really heavy storm can create this kind of rush of water coming from the upper Lee and in the middle Lee Valley, because there'd been so much development up there and so many canals had replaced the river, it really sped up how fast the water moved down the Lee into the lower Lee. And then it hits these centuries old bridges and tidal mills that just sort of stops it and leads to flooding. And finally, you can get these big storms coming up the Thames Estuary. And most of the worst floods are caused by just these huge waves, storm surges coming up the estuary and then going over the flood defenses. So you have these regular and then occasional extreme floods. And this combines or overlaps in 1904 with the beginning of a pretty deep recession that hits West Ham particularly hard. One, because, you know, they shut down the docks for a few weeks. A number of major factories start either closing or significantly reducing their production. But also, this is sort of the moment that West Ham stops growing really quickly. So a whole lot of people who worked in the building industry are thrown out of work. There's less houses being built, less factories being built. So all that comes together to make West Ham kind of the focus of this unemployment crisis. In 1904, 1905, national newspapers and London-wide newspapers, like the Evening Telegraph, you know, raise money to help the unemployed in West Ham. And this is also just sort of a moment where national politicians start to rethink unemployment. They start to recognize that there is this kind of category of the deserving unemployed, people who are thrown out of work because of the economy, not because of their own moral failings. That's a concept that doesn't really exist in the 19th century. You know, people kind of believe there's always work, and people who are unemployed were being too selfish, demanding too high a wage, or they were alcoholics or otherwise work shy one way or another. This idea that the economy just isn't producing enough jobs doesn't exist until about this time frame. So, you know, once you start to identify particularly male breadwinners as being kind of deserving, being thrown out of work, despite having good moral character, it becomes this kind of new social crisis, new focus for the governments and for the newspapers. And there's legislation that's actually passed. It's a much watered down version of some of the big ideas that were first proposed. But legislation to set up what were called distress committees locally that could raise money on their own. Initially, there's no national money to support them, but they could raise money and do various kinds of public work projects. Some were a bit ambitious, like buying a farm outside of the city and getting these urban working class men to go spend 3 months farming with this kind of vague hope that they'd repopulate the countryside. Or maybe
very back to the land, isn't it?
Yeah, back to the land. There's kind of an obsession with this idea of repopulating the countryside, maybe sending a bunch of people over to Canada, Australia. You know, was also in the back of their minds, but they really thought they'd break up these old estates and find way more work for people on the land. Of course, that is kind of an utter failure. But they also take some of their resources and start doing kind of public works projects in parks in nearby West Ham. So in the second winter of this recession, they do this big project to dig out a kind of, there had been a lake in this spot, but it had dried up and there was minor flooding problems in the area. So, you know, basically they buy a lot of shovels and wheelbarrows and bring thousands of unemployed men to dig out this lake, pour some concrete, and create this new kind of recreation space, but also flood management space in on the northern edge of the city. And it's this project, which is considered hugely successful because almost all the money goes straight to giving these unemployed men work, gets the engineer, West Ham's borough's engineer, thinking maybe I can use the unemployed next year to clean out some of these rivers. And so he writes the engineer at the Lee Conservancy Board, who are tasked with managing the canal section of the Lee, and proposes kind of this joint project between West Ham and the Lee Conservancy Board, funded by national money. The Liberals had just won an election and were willing to put some money into supporting these unemployed workers. that, you know, they kind of started to dream big, and they come up with this very ambitious plan to completely remake the Lower Lee River, to dig canals, put proper sort of cement canal walls, you know, a very large multi-year project that they imagine might get funding. It seems to correlate with a debate that's happening inside of the Liberal cabinet and also between the Liberals and the new Labour Party about this idea of a right to work. If the Labour Party has proposed that everybody who wants to work should be allowed to work, and the government should be responsible for finding jobs for those that, you know, there aren't jobs in the economy for. The Liberal Party is not interested in supporting anything that radical, but it does get a few of them thinking they need to do something fairly big, to put a lot more money into these public works projects. In the end, that side of cabinet loses out in a much more restrictive funding package from the Chancellor of the Exchequer comes forward. And in the same weeks and months that the ambitions of an expanded unemployment relief from the national government decline, the ambitions of these two engineers also decline. They go from hoping to do all of the back streams, the back rivers, to maybe doing one, to eventually giving up on the project altogether. And so the interesting thing is that another 20 years goes by. There's another major flood in 1928, bigger than either the previous large floods. And of course, the economy collapses and unemployment skyrockets again at the end of the 1920s. So they finally do this project that, that had been first proposed in 1908, starting in 1930. So between 1930 and 1935, they dramatically reshape the river network. They turn all these streams into canals. They in fact, move some of the rivers. They expand the road at the same time. So it's an even more ambitious plan. But we see the same two factors, this desire to solve this huge social problem of prolonged unemployment in the region with, you know, this decade-long desire to re-engineer the Lower Lee network so that it could transport goods more efficiently and spur on the industrial economy, finally comes to fruition, but is ultimately a failure, at least in the second desire. The industrial economy by this point is in a protracted decline. The bombing of the Second World War exacerbates it further, and it never recovers in the second half of the 20th century.
And so West Ham then, it's really a fascinating combination of the quite specific local circumstances of the river, of the marshland there, but also of national and even global, both political and economic forces. Jim Clifford, it has been a real pleasure to speak to you. I've learned a ton about this book and about the topic from this book. I have a hardcover copy. Do you know if there's a paperback edition on the way?
The paperback's been out since March.
Oh, has it? Oh, fantastic. Okay.
Fairly reasonably priced. It's $32 Canadian. I can't remember the American price offhand. But 20
to 25 probably then. Which means that this book, I think, would be a terrific candidate for undergraduate or graduate seminars. And I'm strongly considering assigning it in my own classes next year. So would you like to tell us about your future projects? What do you have on the horizon?
Yeah, so part of converting this project from a dissertation into a book involved expanding the GIS database from all the factories in London to all the factories in West Ham to all the factories in Greater London for both those time points that we have the 5 feet to the mile maps for. And so that was a part of the next project that I've been sort of working on off and on again over the past 6 years now, trying to explore, instead of the local social and environmental consequences of industrialization in London, trying to look at the global environmental consequences of these same factories. So by identifying all the factories in Greater London, I've started to see a number of them that relied on raw materials coming from the rest of the world. So leather, which needed hides first from South America and by the end of the 19th century from just about everywhere in the world, but also tannins and barks from all around the world. That quinine factory in West Ham needs cinchona, first from the Andes, and then there's this huge effort to move it to Sri Lanka in southern India that ultimately fails. So it's kind of exploring these different commodity histories and connecting them to the industrial history of London and the history of different kinds of environmental consequences at the sites of extraction or plantations in different parts of the world.
Well, we look forward to hearing much more from you, and thank you very much for your time today. Once again, the book is Jim Clifford, West Ham and the River Lee, A Social and Environmental History of London's Industrialized Marshland, 1839 to 1914. Thank you so much, but it's been a great pleasure.
Thanks a lot.